The Big Interview. It's The Big Interview with me, Peter, where I get to chat to interesting people about their life. And my guest for this edition is Henry Haight, who's an American-born visual and tattoo artist who's worked with more LGBT plus icons than you can shake a stick at. From Thomas Finland to Amy Winehouse, Alexander McQueen, Boy George and Tom Grennan, well, to name but a few, Henry's work fuses modern popular culture, weaving a dialogue exploring taboos on sex, faith, sin and salvation. That's a podcast series in itself. Henry, hello, my love.
Hello, how are you?
I'm living the dream, sat opposite an icon in his own right.
I don't know about that, but thank you for that. Oh. High praise indeed.
Oh, modesty. Tell me about you. Tell me about growing up, Henry. Where did that all happen?
I grew up in Southern California, Los Angeles region. I was born in Orange County, and my formative years were in Hollywood and that base in downtown. Grew up in the, came up through the punk rock scene. And, you know, I started to, then there was the development, like with the AIDS epidemic, there was the homo-queer culture things. Queer culture then is much, much different than it
yeah.
is now. Because it was a pushback from the clones and, you know, anti-establishment in a sense. And I really took to that because within the punk scene, it was okay to be a freak or an oddity in some ways. And, you know, you didn't have any money. You dressed how you wanted. Everyone felt like a freak and you were encouraged to stand out and stick out.
And, so, and was that just the Los Angeles scene or was this happening all across the U.S.?
Well, I think it was in major metropolises, you know, in Hollywood, you know, and like New York, people go there to chase a dream or try to figure out something and they already feel like an anomaly. And then when they find these people, there were drag bars and stuff. But when I moved out of Los Angeles and I joined the Army and I found myself in Georgia, I found more drag queens, more art students and stuff, and just as wild and eccentric as, and even further than the ones in Hollywood. Because I think that when, you know, when you're already feeling like an oddball and, you know, you feel like a hump on your back, throw some glitter on it and just embrace those shortcomings and use it as a strength. And that's the thing I've always loved.
So there you are. Yeah. You're this self-proclaimed freak, punk, enjoying life, bohemian lifestyle. And then you join the Army.
Yeah.
What's that about? Well, did you do in the Army?
I was looking for a few good men.
Amen, sister. Aren't we all in life?
No, but I joined because at the time they were giving the GI Bill and they would give you up to, they would pay for your college education. And I wasn't a very great student, but I excelled at art and like reading and writing. So I wanted to do something that was quite creative. And I figured if I did 2 years in the service, that would virtually pay for my art education. And then again, through that, I found the gay military. And this is just before Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Yeah.
And they had different codes. Like people like us, they would say, are you PLU or are you family?
Family, yes, we've got that.
You know, and but I was like, they go, are you PLU? And I'm like, what's is that a code? And then a PLU, people like us. So that was kind of...
I'm going to write that down. I like that one. I PLU?
Yeah, are you PLU? And I, you know, it was easy to identify the lesbians, but with some of the gays, as gay men, we're all in this uniform and stuff. And ironically, when I see military gay porn, it has no interest. I've been there, done
been
it.
Been there, done it. That, yeah, bought the like, T-shirt, love. Still the village people, happy now.
Yeah, so that was, I was in there for 2 years and... I enjoyed myself. I learned a lot, you know.
And are there skills that you use in today's life? Or
yeah.
Could you erect a tent if we went out into the woods?
Erect a tent, you know, dig a moat to if it rains or whatever, find water, like make a compass and stuff.
Look at you, a man of many. Forget all this tattooing. Yeah, you should be even, the new you know, Bear Grylls.
Really
you could be out
ropes.
There, love. You move over to the UK.
Now, this is a time when Clinton's president and things are going to get better for us because Blair's just come in. What was kind of, was it a, I mean, obviously it'll be a culture shock coming to a new country, but what was the shock for you in gay culture? Was it other than bars used to shut at 2 a.m. and used to be a bit lost, what was it like?
The gay shock culture here was that every guy that I slept with had a boyfriend.
And yeah, nothing's changed there, love.
And virtually, after sleeping with them, I saw them like a week later, I would just get ghosted, like hard, like worse than Los Angeles ghosting. It was just like, you might as well, you know, end your career. That, to me, that was pure cancel culture. They're just like, you don't exist. I don't know who you are.
We never met.
I know her and fuck that. I really found that really hard to do. But the weird thing was that here, early on, in Los Angeles, you know, I didn't eat bread. I didn't drink, like, Coca-Cola or anything. It was, I got dressed to go to the gym. Here, people just let you, every taste and size. There was no, you know, Muscle Marys here. That culture hadn't really seeped in.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, but it was extremely diverse and, I would say, more body positive than it is now, early on. And this is, again, before social media.
Yeah.
So I think we were more reactionary to our instinctual tastes of what we found attractive and how we interacted with each other, because we were more of a unified tribe rather than a divisive cliques, so to speak.
And did you find a difference in attitudes towards sexual health, HIV, AIDS? I mean, obviously, coming from America, Los Angeles, California, you know, San Francisco, those areas where, and obviously the other side, New York, where we kind of imagine that it there would be marches and people would know and there'd be support structures. Was there that in the UK when you came over?
I don't think it was. I remember early on going to Pride marches, and one of my friends, Brandy, who was HIV positive in the early 90s, was my first official friend to have it diagnosed. And he would drag me to these organizations called Being Alive, which he used to call Barely Alive. And they would have meet and greets and, you know, protests and stuff. So I went as supporting him. And virtually through, especially with the queer culture, it was very vocal about the treatment and, you know, post-Reagan era, where funds were allocated. When I came to the UK, you know, the medical, because you had universal health care, you already had kind of a safety net.
Yeah.
But I think that from an outsider looking in, most gay men didn't have that looming threat of, you know, medicine or where it was coming from here. So yeah. I think that was, they didn't have much of a fear factor, whereas as an most Americans, especially
how are you gonna pay
medical
for it?
Yeah, how are you going to pay for this?
What insurance and so on?
But I think what was refreshing here is that there was this extreme sex positivity and, you know, clinics that virtually helped you, whereas when in Los Angeles, when you went to the free clinic, you're going with drug addicts, prostitutes. You know, that's always exciting to a certain degree, but there's this impending threat that you might get mugged, robbed, or, you know, catch scabies, which apples and oranges. But I found it really refreshing here that there was still some anonymity, but it seemed there was, like the English, a bit of dignity to go into these places without any shame, which I found really refreshing. And, you know, I remember seeing the freedoms in the bars and stuff before people were thinking about who's going to pay for that too. It's a cost. But it promoted safe sex, you know, before the days of PrEP. So, and to know your status, so which was, you know, the driving message. And I started to go check every 6 months. And if you're sexually active, you know, I got into the habit of getting myself checked every 3 months just to get a screen, because
you just liked the fact that it was free. You just thought, this
free,
is great. I'm going to turn up every day. I'll get a coffee.
At the pace of some of the guys that I had, like a stable of playmates, that, you know, I didn't know who they were playing with. So, you know, now, like with something like monkeypox, viruses are becoming stronger and more drug resistant. So it, and I know, especially since the global pandemic, it is crucial and necessary for self-care to just get checked. You know, if women could get, a pap smear every so often, gay men should actually remove the taboo and stigma of just, you know, getting a rectal swab, a throat swab. There's no shame in being a hoe, but, you know, you should.
Just as long as you're checked.
Yeah, as long as you're checked and, you know, you're not the, you know, local typhoid Mary.
Well, I tell you what, that's the name of the next podcast. There's No Problem Being a Hoe with Henry Hay. We could do a 6-part series. When did tattooing come into it? Were you doing this in the States? Did it happen when you arrived in the UK? Or
I started at the time I was working for Tom of Finland and working in porn.
Okay, let's scrap the tattoo. Let's go to this. So elaborate a little bit for me on that, would you?
I was a hair and makeup artist for porn.
Because obviously you win a load of awards in porn for hair and makeup, don't you?
No, not really. You actually get paid more for the box cover. And again, this is before internet, because back then, everyone, even gay men, the amount of money they put on the production for the box or the slick,
yeah,
you're looking at an 8-hour, 10-hour shoot,
yeah, yeah,
for just that one model or two models or whatever. And the, you know, Vogue airbrushing and all that goes into that. So that's, again, before the internet, that's what people
videos and DVDs.
To.
Yeah.
So you do the production for a day, and that'd be about 12 to 14. Sometimes if the chemistry was off, you'd be there 18 hours.
But did you think some days you walked in and thought, Christmas, I've been good, you know, this is a wonderful job? Or is it that you get, you know, past the idea of what it is? It's just the hair's got to be right, and it's 18-hour days, and I'm tired, and I'm in a cold place.
Well, no, it's kind of like joining the circus, because you have this troop of people that you're in different locations, you're in houses, you know, you're in, like, Hollywood castle looking like makeshift places, sound stages, places like this, you know, just for the day. You have a chef, you have a wardrobe person, you have, you know, all the stuff that you would have in a regular film production. And you're there from 7 a.m. to whenever. And, you know, you all break for lunch. There's a chef. I never bought food when I worked on porn sets.
But everybody had to wash the hands.
But the weird thing was that when, you know, you think for it would take about 3 hours to make a 20-minute loop if the chemistry was right. Sometimes if they were really good, you know, depending guys or girls, it'd be an hour, hour and a half. Like that was an easy shoot. Sometimes the couple would, oh God, I remember there was one that was like 6 hours just to get three positions. But the weird thing is it becomes quite clinical.
Yeah, yeah.
And you become oblivious to it. And, you know, there's always talking behind, you know, the staff, the crew about some of the talent and, you know, watching guys try to like remain hard.
Yeah.
And some guys would be really bitchy, say something to the other actor to keep him from performing.
What, so that they jump in and get the fee, or?
Oh, well, no, I remember once.
Oh, was it just one-upmanship?
There was this guy, Peter North. He told one of the other actors, you're looking a little chubby. And he said it while filming, and all of a sudden you just saw his dick just drop. And we sat there for about 3 hours watching him try to, like, jock off a guy. And you're just like, you start questioning, how the fuck did I get in here? This is my normal. And, you know, I'd hang out with the makeup department, the art department, the set dressers, and, you know, the wardrobe girl. We just talk smack about everybody, or, you know, the craft service girl and the chef, and just because that was fun. And I look back at those days with a lot of relish, because like with what's happening with gay culture, there seems to be this narrative that, you know, people are being trafficked. And, you know, I think, you know, sex work is sex work, but it provides a service. And, you know, if everyone's there as a willing participant and consents to it and taking part in it, it serves its purpose for people who look at it as harmless fun, or, you know, marital aid, whatever, that gets them through that. So I've
and,
always...
and we noticed, particularly during lockdown, that people went into OnlyFans and things, partly to make an income because they weren't earning any other way. And it was content creation boom.
But even Pornhub gave everyone free, like, and I, Pornhub's giving me 3 months of free porn. Sure, why not?
Do you ever see some of your old work and
I would have styled that differently now. I have found certain people go, oh, I saw a video of you in fur pants as a horned pan. And I'm like, oh, God. And I know which one. Or an art student getting whipped. Yeah, I would do more of the fetish stuff.
Oh, well, you said you did hair and makeup. No, but you never said you were a performer as well.
One gay director took a shine, like a real good shine to me, and was always trying to get me to do porn. And when he said, would you do a fetish scene with this one particular guy? And I remember looking at the dude going, yeah.
Damn, if I must.
No, which is like, $350 for 2 hours worth of work. Why not? And, it was fun. But at the time I was young and I thought, I'm not hurting anybody. It's consensual. And I always wondered what it would be like to have some sort of interaction, a sexual interaction with a guy. It wasn't hardcore sex, but it was more of a dom and a submissive.
Yeah.
And I also wanted to test my limits on being a submissive to how extreme that could take me. So I looked at it also as a test of endurance. And I'm not ashamed of it.
I want to go down such a different rabbit hole here, but I'm pulling it back because we've talked Tom Finland. Tattooing. Please tell me something. How did that come about?
Well, I went to art school, and when you do art school, they you do the graduate show after you, and essentially you hope that a gallery or you get discovered in some way. Now they teach you about the business of how to approach galleries, how to, edit your portfolios and virtually marketing. And this was, again, 30 plus years ago. When I started tattooing, it was a way for me to actually make art, draw, use my talent, and make money. Because going to galleries and stuff was quite a daunting task because you need a body of work. And especially if you're going to be a professional artist, you need archival paints and stuff, materials that aren't cheap. So tattooing was a way for me to do that. And at the time, I was working for Tom of Finland and maybe 6 days in porn sets a month. So I had all this free time. And I took an apprenticeship through some friends who encouraged me to hang out at a tattoo shop. And again, the days before social media, I was living in Silver Lake, which is, unlike West Hollywood, Silver Lake has a huge leather community.
Yeah.
With all the leather bars there. West Hollywood queens go to Silver Lake when they need a top,
And we're not talking about a blouse here. We're talking about a gentleman.
Yeah, not blouse born. But the weird thing was that within that area, I was able to find guys to virtually hone my craft in like a particular style, especially with erotic images that they were willing to have on them. And again, there weren't a lot of gay tattoos. I knew certain gay tattooers from old time, like Phil Sparrow and Cliff Raven. And again, you kind of had to go through word of mouth and virtually do a hustle of trying to find these particular people. And as I started to cultivate this, I kind of hit like a glass roof. And I broke up with my partner at the time and I figured I needed to change. And that's when I decided to come to London. And so I already had these talents to say, okay, I know the Hollywood hustle of how to network.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I hit the clubs. I met all the right promoters and virtually kind of said, hey, I can tattoo you and do give free things and stuff like that to put my name out there.
Yeah.
And at the time I was working in the red light district, which again, put myself right in the thick of things.
Yeah.
In Walker's Court, Diamond Jacks. Uh-huh. And there was where, the Sex Pistols got tattooed, the Stray Cats, Billy Idol. So there was already this rock and roll thing. So I was kind of, at the time, I didn't see it as the building blocks of my my lineage of and within my career and trajectory, but it kind of all fits into place, yeah. which I find quite daunting that it just through osmosis and by serendipity, it happened that way.
And I mentioned at the start, you know, the list of celebs and whatnot that you've worked with. But one of the things we were at the launch of this new piece of art, which we'll talk about. And next to the art, there was big frames with tabloid headlines about you, about the celebrities that you've done and about you. And I'm interested in that where you were tattooing celebrities, but then the spotlight was shone on you. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. I, like Gareth Thomas, I got outed by the Sun for my HIV status. And because I was a tattoo artist, there was this preconceived notion that I had to disclose my HIV status to the general public. And like much like dentists, we have to go through stringent inspections through environmental health, the local council. They come to see, you know, how you operate and like, are you, you know, getting rid of your contaminated waste, you know, in the medical way to possible to like minimize all infections. But what they didn't realize is that the newspaper kind of made me feel like I was the monkey from Outbreak. Or Contagion, you know, that I was this virus is like peddling and some global microbiology threat to the greater community, which in hindsight, if you think if someone has a diminished immune system, that anything that the other person has would be a threat to that certain individual. So I kind of kept my status under wraps, but I was getting checked. I had been positive for 9 years. And at the time, they weren't giving you, they didn't just put you on treatment. They just checked to go, you're fine, you're healthy. This is, and I was doing that twice a year. And then all of a sudden, this fell in my lap that someone who had the out to get me tried to out me through the Sun. And the Sun took it upon themselves that I had to tell people about mm-hmm. my personal stuff, even though I was following the local and health guidelines to keep everything safe, the other people safe as well as myself. And, you know, I was always stringent. And if anyone who has a tattoo shop knows, it's hard to fucking make. Oh, is it okay?
It's, right. Yes,
yes. It's hard to make.
Too late fucking, now, love.
It's hard to make young staff follow health protocols when they're just lazy and slovenly. And you just go, look. A customer sees this. If you do this, they think this is permissible. No, you have to follow certain, you know, protocols to protect yourself as well as the customer. So, you know, you have to watch your bedside manner. It's imperative. And yet, I was treated as if I was, you know, a physical threat to people.
Did you know it was happening? Did they contact you the day before and say, we're running a story on you, you've got a right to reply? Or did you wake up one day and you go, oh, I'm on page one?
This guy just virtually showed up at my door. He showed up at the shop. And I'll never forget, he was this podgy guy in a grease-stained cheap suit. I remember he had, like, gravy stains on his blazer.
Lovely.
And he was just like a comb-over. An older man, and his name was Chris. And he was like, you know, you're supposed to. And when he said this, it was the first time I'd ever been addressed about the subject from anyone other than my doctor and my husband.
Yeah.
And I was just like, what the fuck just happened? Yeah. How is it? It's like, I'm sorry, what? And he's like, well, we're running a story and we've been told by a source. And when he said the source, I kind of started to figure out it would have been one of four people who knew. Because I didn't post it on social media or anything. It was, when he left, I hadn't even told the local council. So I called the local council and I said, here's the issue. I'm licensed. You've licensed me for the last 9 years. I get inspections. I'm HIV positive. And the woman goes, oh. And she's like, well, we've never had this issue before. And I'm like, what do you mean? And she's like, well, we do, like, no one's ever come to us at the Environmental Health and said, oh, by the way, I'm HIV positive. She's like, we have to discuss it with the Environmental Health higher ups and see about what, because I had the license. Mm-hmm. And like, would this affect my business or my license? And she's like, I have to get back to you. And the very next day, it went to print and it made the cover and page 4. I didn't make page 3.
Damn.
And I just remember I got a text about 7:30 in the morning from a friend from Brighton going, you look amazing. And I was like, what? And she was like, she just took a little shitty clip on her flip phone of the, you know, Amy Winehouse tattooist has HIV. And I was like, fuck. And sure enough, I got to the tube station, there they were. And my phone just like click, 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 click with all these text messages. And, you know, and one of my friends who works at the NME said it was on their table in the conference room. And people were talking about it. Like, why the fuck would this matter?
So, but the text messages that you were getting were supportive?
They were from all my friends who had my number. And they were all supportive. But right. One of my friends who had a better phone at the time, an iPhone, sent me a photo of it in the NME offices on the conference table. And she's like, are you okay? And that was the first one that's like, you know, we're all talking about it. And I was like, yeah, I'm good. And I remember that day I tattooed Alex Foden, who was Amy Winehouse's friend.
Yeah.
And he knew because he was gay. So, you know, I felt like, okay, there's the gay mafia kind of thing. And Amy was in St. Lucia. And I was freaking out because all of a sudden people were like, you're the guy in the sun. And that's the unwanted attention you don't want. Suddenly people know something that you consider very, very private.
Yes.
And I remember I didn't get on the tube. I took a cab. So that was about 30 quid from Notting Hill to Shoreditch. And, you know, the following day, the council called me and said, you're good. I was bawling in my shop in front of about 15 customers, like, because it was really emotional, because I felt like, okay, there's a ray of hope in this.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, the following day, my husband's mother died and he had to leave, and I couldn't leave because Home Office had my passport. Right. So it was an extremely stressful point. And he, like, Terrence Higgins Trust was like, okay, we're going to give you this person to appoint and we're going to see what we can do with you. And I was like, can't we sue? And they were like, well, no, if it's the truth, you're HIV positive, they've printed the truth. So, and I'm like, well, it's still somewhat slanderous in a sense of they've, you know, if Naomi Campbell can walk out of an AA meeting and sue them.
Yeah,
you know,
it's your private medical history.
Yeah, it's private information. But they actually gave my name, my full actual real name, my shop address. They didn't think of the staff who had about 8 people who worked under me.
Yeah, yeah.
They were all could be targeted. And during that 2 days, I got about 40 calls from all girls, young girls who'd been pierced, not by me, but by my staff going, should I get an AIDS test? And the weird thing was that they never call it an HIV test. They would just go, oh, I need to get an AIDS test.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, and I never really understood that line of thinking. You know, my friend Brandy, when he used to get a cold, he used to joke, oh, my AIDS is flaring up. And I used to find that really funny. I know now you can't say that.
No.
Because it's, you know, I don't want to offend the wokes or, you know, offend their safe spaces, but that was the humor back then.
Yes.
And, I had to think about my staff. And when I talked to a lawyer, they're like, well, the Sun have a lot of money. And the only person who's ever taken on the Sun and won is Elton John. And I don't play piano. You know, I don't have hair like a lunch lady. You know, I don't wear those awful suits that he wears with the glasses and, you know, or those.
We love you, Elton, if you're listening, really.
Well, I like his early stuff, but, you know,
All right, you don't backpedal here, love. You go for it.
No, so but the weird thing was that Elton John sued one, but he was actually gay, and and I'm like, oh, I don't have that kind of fucking money. So I did find a media lawyer, who was amazing, and I asked him two questions. I go, "Are you a shark? And do you think you could take these cocksuckers on?" He's all, "Absolutely." He was dead serious. And I remember when we sat in his office, he grilled me like a fucking cheeseburger, like asking me all kinds of questions about my sex life. Just like, because he goes, "This is what you're going to, if we go to trial, this is what they're going to do."
Yeah.
And I answered every question. I thought, I'm going to be as truthful as possible. You know, he's like, "How many dicks didn't say how many dicks, but how many phalluses have you sucked in a weekend?"
"Which weekend?"
Yeah, and I was like, "Are we talking Leather Pride or?" he was a matter of fact,
yeah.
Because all of a sudden, he reasoned that because of my HIV status, my personal life as well as my professional life were going to come into play of why they figure how they're going to make this narrative. And he wanted to see if I could withstand that. So he went on the attack with me for 30 minutes, just like boom, 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 boom. And I held my pace and I just thought, shit, this is really overwhelming.
Yeah.
But I'm like, no, my gut said, I trust this fucking guy. He's the right man.
And you took the son on and?
And I won.
And
I got an additional $5,000 for them taking, going through my social media and taking photos of my clients, like Preston from The Ordinary Boys and Amy Winehouse and Pete Doherty. Because they were just taking things.
Yes, no.
And I was just like, how is this possible?
But what did winning mean? Obviously there'd been a settlement. Was there a full page apology? Or was it actually that didn't matter for me?
No, it didn't matter to me. But looking back, I think what I knew I wasn't going to get a retraction or, you know, because at the end of the article, it said it's not known if he has given anyone HIV. But because they labeled, you know, Amy, alcoholic, drug addict, Pete Doherty, homosexual, Boy George. It was just this really salacious thing. Like we were having this, you know, league of, you know, Satanists and sexual orgy, you know, 93 festival and all getting together. It was awful. It was a hit piece. And I thought, okay. And I thought there's a number. There's this, a five-figure number that I thought would be. But then when I thought, no, I should have asked for six. Not in the high, but
No.
You know, but the weird thing is that because I had to learn how the UK laws here work,
yeah.
They work in favor of the top dogs. They don't work for the little guy. Whereas in America, something like this, there's no way they would fucking be able to do that.
No.
And, you know, and in that way, that was refreshing. But I really felt like I was vulnerable to everything. I didn't know whether my business would survive, especially being a gay man in a boys club in the tattoo industry and being out and having these high profile people that now a lot of people kill for that kind of clientele.
Yeah.
I was like, fuck, you know, and.
And how was the clientele? Did it turn away from you?
Did they support Amy and Boy George were really supportive. I remember Boy George's brother also called me that day and he's like, "You know what? Don't worry about this." Because Boy George had a shop across the street in front of Shoreditch Church and it was called Be Rude. And he sold all these really cool clothes. And I used to wear a lot of, he would just give me this free stuff swag to wear. So I rocked it at work when I didn't tattoo. But, you know, and the thing is that when they were telling me this, they were going through their own turmoils with the press.
Yeah.
You know, Amy was in St. Lucia trying to get away from things, the dissolve of her marriage. And Boy George was in New York being hounded, picking up trash. And then he also had the case where he had chained an escort to the wall of his flat. And so there was all this hearsay and speculation of these things. And I felt like, well, if these two people are in my corner, I'll take it. you know, and
they'll know about bad publicity. Well, and they know how to ride it.
I think the weird thing about both of them is that they are so resilient on letting that shit go that, you know, they're still human and they had, but it was kind of, when we look at media now, there's this relishment of feeding the Christians to the lions that make people, their droll lives feel better. And yet these people have significant talent and have a body of work that really is impactful on our lives. And yet they're kind of somehow vilified. Now, you know, we look at these type of things, addictions and traumas, in a different way, because now the subject of mental health, especially since the pandemic, and everyone has spent months in isolation, and we've seen, you know, suicide go up, and now, you know, the topics of transgender and all these other things that kind of encompass our mental, physical well-being. And, you know, addictions are just a distraction from these dilemmas that we really are trying to grapple with. And how do we accept our own personal weaknesses and try to turn them into strengths? And that was one of the hardest things I had to do, because no one wants to be, oh, the HIV tattooist. Yeah, you know, that's not a sash.
It's not catchy for the title, is it?
You know, a tiara with a bunch of needles. And no, that's not me. In lieu of that, it didn't kill my business, but it actually thrived, because the first company that approached me after that was Nissan Motors, and they wanted me to launch the Nissan Cube. And when they asked me, I was just like taken aback, because this was like a major global brand that's saying, we want you for this, and we're going to make put a cube in ice, and we want you to make an ice tattoo. And they, you know, they had the full PR machine going and stuff. And the HIV thing skimmed it, but it was more of the work which I wanted to be. And so they did do an amazing job, but I did have to go through, like with my solicitor, an hour and a half of a media consultant telling me how to answer questions to skirt the issue of HIV. And the weird thing was, I wasn't ashamed of it, but I don't see how this is going to make anyone's life more, benefit them from, if I'm never meeting these people.
No.
You know.
But here you are now, talking openly about your HIV status and your artwork. And it almost seems to have come full circle, because you've teamed up with Eyes Open, which is why you're in the Northeast now, created this amazing piece of artwork that's done the tour round. Do you think if you'd have jumped on a TARDIS back to the 70s and 80s when you were a punk and saying, hello, Henry, this is what's going to happen in your life, would you have just sat there and gone, yeah, bring it on? Or would you have told yourself to have done anything differently?
That's a good question, because I think the first reaction, knee-jerk reaction, is like, yes, you know. But no, I wouldn't change anything, because it brought me to this level. But I learned a lot about myself, as well as trying to accept this. And the weird thing is that I think when we have failures in life, that is when we learn the most about ourself and how to be resilient and overcome certain things. Oddly, I didn't hit a major drug addiction or things like that within at that time, because it was just maddening. But I just told myself I had to fucking work through it. And my clients were supportive of me. My staff were still with. They didn't. None of them quit. But they knew that I was gay, and I'd virtually told them, and they were like, okay, fine, yeah, well, we're not having sex. And I'm like, you know, okay. And, you know, I make it a rule not to sleep with my clients. I don't shit where I eat.
Yep.
Well, I've just broken that rule maybe 5 times in 30 years.
So you're teasing me now with another two hours of chatting, but I'll have to come back to that.
But the weird thing is that when all this happened, I really am thankful that it kind of let the genie out of the bottle, because it brought on something like Nissan, and then that just snowballed with other brands. And the weird thing is, I never called myself an artist, because I felt like I didn't deserve it. and I somehow an imposter, and I'm just a tattoo artist. But it eventually evolved and gravitated towards something much, much bigger. And I really had to learn, okay, if I can accept my HIV diagnosis, I also have to accept the role that I choose to be an actual artist. And by the time I was 44, I was like, yeah, I guess I am. I've been doing this a while now, so yeah, I'm an artist.
And you are. You've created this amazing piece of art for Eyes Open. Tell me about that.
I've been blessed to do this piece of work for the U Equals U campaign, which is undetectable, means untransmittable. But in the painting, I've taken the huge trajectory and history of HIV, as well as the people who died from the AIDS crisis. And instead of making a quilt, try to symbolize the leaps and bounds, as well as the loss and the strengths that have happened within this epidemic. And I've made a piece called Monument One, which is based on Leonardo da Vinci's Salvator Mundi, because the controversy is they reject the origin of who this person is, much like an HIV person at first diagnosis. And I remember even seeing my friend Brandy, they would isolate him in, you know, through another room and having to go through medical beds and all that, as well as the people early on in the UK and the die-in protests, their people lying and were beaten and stuff. And I wanted to pay tribute to these people who weren't lucky to witness the leaps and bounds and the advances of medicine that have happened to keep people alive. But all of us stand on their shoulders. So the painting represents a leather jacket, which a lot of gay men and women and the LGBTQ community plus community wear. And I always think that that's an emblem of strength and an armor to them. So there's symbolism within the work that just tells, you know, body markers when we get the blood test to see where our status is and stuff like that inside of the Eye of Horus for, you know, knowledge to virtually keep us known of where we are and where we're going. And virtually it was a daunting task to make something that wouldn't be offensive, but really pay tribute to neighbors, friends, lovers, family members, colleagues that are no longer here, but also to those going, you're going to be okay, and that you are loved.
And then that's the thing, is it's important to know your status, but it's important to know our history as well.
Yes, especially in social media. And I think that the weird thing is that because with woke culture and younger kids, because they have a smartphone, they feel that there's some sort of sense of enlightenment because they have information to them. But to really experience these things or those losses is far greater than anything a hand device can teach us. And I think that, you know, they now look at PrEP as just like, you know, they pop it like candy. But the weird thing is that with something like monkeypox, where that now has come sideways to where we've just got over a global pandemic. And I swear to God, if the next pandemic is a zombie apocalypse, I'm fucking out of here. You know, because it's just like, but we need to know these things to realize that we have to virtually look after ourselves. Yeah. And self-care is one of the hardest things for us to do because we want to put others first or we forget.
Well, Henry, if you want to find out more about my gorgeous guest, visit henryhatefineart.com or check out the socials. It's been an absolute joy chatting
Thank
to
you. Thank you for having
now
me.
Now then, would you paint me in the nude? You know, can we talk about a private commission?
Well, I'd like to take your photo so I could take a drawing of you, if you don't mind.
There you go. You know, sign it, love. We'll get it on eBay. We'll make a fortune. Thanks, Henry.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
The Big Interview.